In 1987, I was in Weimar in East Germany for the annual meeting of the German Shakespeare Society. The meeting began with a long march, a funeral cortege through the streets of Weimar to the statue of Shakespeare in the Weimar Public Gardens. And there, by the statue, there began a set of speeches. The speeches went something like this: just as Prospero in The Tempest gives up his magic at the end, so Ronald Reagan should give up Star Wars. I was fascinated and amused and haunted by these speeches because I realized that this was in the communist regime, but in the fascist regime during the Nazi period, there would also have been such speeches, and the speeches would have been about how Shakespeare understood something about the Jews in The Merchant of Venice. I think that Shakespearean universality is as much disturbing as it is a source of celebration.
Literary critic Stephen Greenblatt. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about William Shakespeare and literary scandals. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this program comes from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of language and literature. To his most vehement critics, William Shakespeare is just another dead white male. To his devoted admirers, he represents artistic supremacy and universality. But according to critic Stephen Greenblatt, such oversimplified polarities leave little room for negotiating with Shakespeare. For seeing him as an artist who deliberately presents us with the painful dimensions of human behavior, as well as our happier aspects. Stephen Greenblatt teaches at the University of California at Berkeley and is a regular visiting professor at Harvard University. His most recent books include Shakespearean Negotiations and Marvelous Possessions. The New York Times calls him the most prominent Renaissance scholar of his generation. With the first segment in a series of conversations about language and literature in the modern world, Stephen Greenblatt is here now to discuss what he calls the embarrassments or scandals of great literature. In short, powerful art from the past that expresses values and fantasies, for example, about race or sex or class, that make us extremely uncomfortable today. Stephen Greenblatt, welcome to the National Humanities Center. We're going to talk about William Shakespeare. Now, there he is. He's a monument. Some people venerate him. Some people adore William Shakespeare. And yet, our object today is to talk about him in terms of literary scandal. What do you mean by that?
Well, I suppose by literary scandal, one means the things that make us uncomfortable, the things that seem disturbing, shocking, upsetting. It is true that we venerate Shakespeare, and with lots of good reason. Shakespeare is the object of the center of a cult that is virtually a religious cult, and that has attracted the kind of energies that we usually associate with religious veneration.
Are you one of the worshippers in any fashion?
I regard myself as a high priest, Wayne. But the fact of the matter is, like other priests in other religions, there are things that are difficult to deal with in this inheritance, things that one feels that one has to wrestle with, grapple with.
All right, now let me put a number of issues on the table here, Stephen Greenblatt. Anti-Semitism, power and gender and patriarchy, witchcraft, statecraft, art, and magic. My goodness, we're going to go all over the map here and talk about some of old Gwilym's work. Let's begin with The Merchant of Venice. If I wanted to be uncharitable, I would say, look, this is the work of an anti-Semite. How about this?
Well, it is certainly the case that you can say this is a work that is built around anti-Semitism. Whether you'd want to say it's the work of an anti-Semite is another matter.
That's psychologizing.
Well, it's both psychologizing and identifying in ways that are notoriously tricky in the case of Shakespeare. We don't know what Shakespeare thought about a whole bunch of things. We don't know whether he would have voted Democratic or Republican. We don't know.
So we got to work with the text that's there.
We work
with
the texts. I mean, that we have. We can make certain presumptions, and we can understand, for starters, that this was a playwright who thought, at one point in his career, that he could do a wonderful comedy built out of hatred of Jews, feeling of what Jews are, what they represent.
Now, is this a problem that Shakespeare faced in his own time? Was he doing this for the sake of art alone? Obviously, he wasn't thinking about people. Maybe he was 400 or 500 years down the road reading his work, but I want to understand the circumstances that led to the production of the play.
The immediate circumstances in the production of the play don't have to do with a literal Jewish community. The Jews had been expelled long before from centuries before from England. There were a small number of Jews in England, or converts from Judaism in England, but that's not the issue. The issue is a long-term, very deeply rooted set of Christian thoughts about Jews, symbolic thoughts about Jews, that nonetheless have also very long-term, and in this case, very unpleasant consequences.
All right, now Shakespeare takes the gloves off, basically. He puts on the stage there in front of us the real rough and tumble of, ethnic or racial relationships. Why is he doing this to us if we're supposed to look back and enjoy these plays so much?
Well, we are supposed to enjoy them, and we're supposed to laugh at them, and we're supposed to take pleasure in them, but the pleasure is a complicated one, laced with anxiety. Shakespeare's comedies in general are comedies that have, for all of their extraordinary sunniness and pleasure, they're also built around lots of pain, fear, dread, anxiety, guilt, and the Merchant of Venice is no exception to this. You have a play that is remarkable in detecting, after all, in the late 16th century, that this will be a place. Hatred between Christians and Jews, hatred between inside and outside, will be a place in which we can construct something very powerful, very energetic, very exciting.
Does Shakespeare seek to resolve this tension? We go back and we look at Shakespeare for some sort of consolation, understanding, solace about who we are and the way we should live today. Is that what he's up to? Is he finally giving us a happy ending so that we can leave the theater and feel good about ourselves?
This is a hard question, Wayne. In some sense, the answer is yes, he does try to resolve it, apparently. He resolves it by having a forced conversion of the Jew to Christianity and the marriage of the Jew's beautiful daughter to a Christian gentleman and the Jew's money going to that gentleman. If that's a happy resolution, and probably did function as a happy resolution for people in various contexts, but context is crucial. Context is crucial. When this is being done, to what audience, with what kinds of feelings, and how much we're willing to recognize that there are conflicted feelings about these issues.
Well, give me a half a minute on that, Stephen Greenblatt. How did the audiences of Elizabethan England receive this play, and does that reception differ appreciably from what we experience today?
We don't have any reviews that survive from the period, Wayne. We don't know how audiences receive it. There is a long stage tradition that had Shylock as a grotesque with a weird nose and a red wig. This would suggest that it wasn't a sentimental account of Shylock. We also know that the play, for example, The Jump Way Ahead of in Time, was put on quite enthusiastically in Nazi Germany. So that it, in particular context, it's unquestionably the case that this play can be used for anti-Semitic purposes.
Let's talk, Stephen Greenblatt, about The Taming of the Shrew. Here you have a stereotypical embodiment, a put-down of women, or a handling, an authoritarian handling of women, that you put this in the wrong hands, and people will look at it and say, well, there it is, Shakespeare's telling us that we can push women around. How about this?
Well, as with The Merchant of Venice, we could say that in a given context, given a particular set of assumptions, we could indeed say that about Taming of the Shrew, that it's a play that says what you really ought to do if you have a recalcitrant wife is a little beating, a little starving. Actually, Petruchio doesn't beat Kate. That was in Shakespeare's sources, but he doesn't do it. But a little deprivation, sleep deprivation, food deprivation, that's what'll do him. But the fact is that with Taming of the Shrew, as with The Merchant of Venice, that's only one possibility. These plays are remarkably diverse in what can be done with them, and I believe that they were deliberately so. That is to say, I think that Shakespeare was alert to the possibility of doing it differently.
Where did we lose this sense, Stephen Greenblatt, of figuring out the alternatives? That is, the way when we go into the theater and sit down, or if the text is there in front of us, where did we lose this sense of what you call diversity in our reactions to a play like this? I can imagine, for example, a feminist reader or critic looking at The Taming of the Shrew and saying, no, it doesn't have anything to do with bossing women around. It has to do with teaching men how to interact with women. Now, is that too simplistic?
I don't think we've ever lost the sense of diversity, except that I think that at given moments, people become embattled, fierce in their response, and that's as it should be. I think the plays anticipate that as well. But the reason that the plays are alive, the reason they mean something to us now, is precisely that they're places in which people can argue and think and take quite different sides.
This is the word negotiation comes to mind. There's a book that somebody wrote that has that in the title. How about this? You negotiate Shakespeare, right?
Well, there are lots of ways in which we can approach Shakespeare, and the simplest thing to say for a start is that we have to, if we want to deal with them at all. That is to say, we can't receive Shakespeare passively. Shakespeare is not something, a collection of, for example, of a book of virtues, a collection of happy thoughts that we're supposed to simply imbibe. It's a much more complex relation that is demanded of us in relation to Shakespeare. He asks for us, as a condition of our pleasure, to respond.
Well, part of this response is understanding the historical circumstance that goes into what the composition and the production and the development of the plays over years and years and years. I'm thinking of Macbeth and the question of witchcraft. Tell me about this.
Well, to my way of thinking, this is an important part, at least of understanding Shakespeare and ultimately of taking full pleasure from Shakespeare. But it's a pleasure that is laced with difficulty. Let's start, as you say, with Macbeth, with the fact that Macbeth was written at a time in which it is actually possible to accuse women of witchcraft and try them, torture them, execute them. It makes a difference, or it should make a difference, it seems to me, in our understanding of the play, a play that does, after all, depict weird sisters who are witches. It makes a difference that this was a play written and first performed at a time in which not only this is possible, but crucially, Wayne, it's a time in which there was a dispute about whether witches existed or not. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1584, a man named Reginald Scott wrote a book, an Englishman named Reginald Scott wrote a book called The Discovery of Witchcraft, in which he said, stop the killing. We must stop killing these women because they're innocent. They may be obnoxious, they may be foolish, but they're innocent. We know that Shakespeare read that book. We know from philological grounds. He used certain of the words that he took from Reginald Scott. Scott says the people who are responsible for the killing of these women, principally responsible, are poets. They're writers who are convincing ordinary people that such crazy things exist.
Well, now, what you have raised here, Stephen Greenblatt, is the issue of imagination, that it cuts in at least a couple of directions. On the one hand, we present an issue and invite an audience to look at it and to become complex in its reaction. On the other hand, you can say that the poets bring us these tough issues, misogyny, racism, whatever, and they give us a pat, simple answer. Help me to understand.
Well, not pat or simple, not in case of Shakespeare, but I would say perhaps irresponsible. That I don't think that we should imagine that poets are the most responsible members of a polity. They may be the most important, the most beautiful, the most eloquent and powerful.
Visible.
But we shouldn't imagine that ethics, aesthetics, and politics are all the same thing, or that they line up terribly neatly. They don't line up neatly. If I were looking for a hero on the subject of witchcraft in the late 16th and early 17th century, I would say Reginald Scott, yes, not William Shakespeare.
Well, now, how does this come out in the wash, so to speak? I mean, how, enormously to oversimplify, Stephen Greenblatt, how did audiences then react to Macbeth, and why is it being read, for example, in the 1990s as a kind of political tract?
Well, we don't know how audiences reacted. What we know is that in the play, Macbeth, curiously enough, the witches are not persecuted or killed in the end, even though they're seen as weirdly and obscurely bound up with the killing of a king.
They disappear in the second part of the play, right?
They just disappear. They are not pursued. And that in itself means that whatever Shakespeare was doing, and it's very difficult to say what he was doing, he was at once intervening in a very complex debate, but not, in fact, intervening in the way that we would expect a politician or an intellectual to intervene.
He's inviting us to do the most uncomfortable of tasks, that is, to think for ourselves. And the option is to look back at Shakespeare and say, well, I'll let him do my thinking for me.
He can't do your thinking for you, even on his own terms, because I say there's no way in which you can take pleasure from the play if you simply passively give yourself over to it. It demands active engagement. It's like a sport, sometimes a blood sport, I can testify.
Well, some of the arguments that go on amongst the professors that Shakespeare has become something of a blood sport. Am I right about that?
You're right. It's on the whole. I could show you my wounds, but I've survived.
Let's talk, Stephen Greenblatt, about another of Shakespeare's plays, and that is The Tempest. The charge these days is that The Tempest is incorrectly being read as a tract for imperialism and colonialism. Again, politicizing the bard. Explain this to me.
Well, there has been a controversy about this. I confess, Wayne, that I'm a little puzzled by the controversy. It was the case that in several editorials and elsewhere, my work particularly has been cited as having politicized The Tempest by saying that it's about imperialism. This is no news. It's not, and it's also not, it's scarcely politicizing. The play is built up out of, clearly uses those materials, the materials from the Jamestown, from the Virginia Enterprise. It's probably the case, in fact, that the same, we know it's the case, that the same people who invested in the Virginia colony in the early 17th century were also investing in the theater companies. They're both joint stock companies.
All right, and they're looking at what? The English looking across the ocean and trying to figure out what to make of this, isn't the phrase the Brave New World? And we have Caliban on the one hand, a word that sounds strangely like cannibal. You have Prospero, you have a magician, that is to say, in a way, a politician who's manipulating power. How should we read this play?
Once again, you can't escape the discomfort, the uneasiness. It's in our treasure box. It's in our inheritance, and we have to figure out what to do with it. We're called upon to take some active relation to it. This is a playwright who writes a play about a mysterious ocean island. It happens not to be in the New World. It's somewhere vaguely in the Mediterranean. Uh-huh. And nonetheless, it continually alludes to the New World discoveries that were very much part of the news.
Shakespeare's source was in the New World.
Shakespeare's sources were in the New World, not just one, but several. Uh-huh. There was a shipwreck off the coast of Bermuda that caused a huge stir in England in the early 17th century, and that Shakespeare is clearly using in The Tempest.
All right, well now, again, I want to press you for some sense of resolution here. Should we look at Caliban as an evil, awful, slinky, slimy thing, and take that as an emblem of the way the English were treating the natives of the New World, so to speak, or is there another more productive way to read this play?
Caliban is a monster, Wayne, quite literally. He's not fully human. He's the worst case account in the early 17th century of what a native was like. He stinks. He's unbelievably ignorant. He's brutish. He doesn't know how to speak before the Europeans arrive. He tries to rape the European's daughter. He tries to rebel. He does the worst possible thing from the point of view.
And we're going to learn something from this character?
What is very strange is this character, who is the worst case character, who actually tries to form an alliance with the lower classes, that is to say, with Stefano and Trinculo in this play, and rise up against the ruler. Nonetheless, this character, first of all, in Shakespeare's account, has an extremely powerful claim. "This island's mine by Sycorax, my mother," he says. "I was here first. I had this island." And secondly, by the end of the play, Prospero is forced to say, or brings himself to say, "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine."
Well, again, here we go to the complexity. That is to say, it's not going to be black or white. We have to get into gray areas that invite some discomfort. Your word for it, again, is anxiety.
These are aspects of our inheritance that simultaneously give us pleasure and give us discomfort.
Let's talk, Stephen Greenblatt, about, this wonderful phrase that you have coined, that is to say, the new historicism. Now, you English professors are accused frequently of doing things to literature, not simply with literature, and the new historicism has come in for a charge of, dark political designs, that is to say, that when you go into the classroom, something is happening there that parents and students shouldn't be altogether comfortable with. And yet, as I read your work, I read words like institutions, social anxieties, paying attention to historical detail, what you call the corporate. It's a very big order, but I want you to explain this term to me.
Well, I would start by saying, for myself, as I wrote somewhere once, I began with a desire to speak with the dead. I was concerned with understanding, and I remain concerned with understanding what was before us, what was out there.
What was it like?
I don't regard in that sense, I don't regard Shakespeare as our contemporary, pure and simple. I regard him as a ghost, as someone from a past that is not ours. The strangeness of that past interests me. And so one of the things that I hope goes on in my classroom is some encounter with something that is not the same as we are, that is not a glimpse, a mirror image of ourselves.
You say that you want to make the familiar what? You want to be uneasy with the familiar and vice versa?
I want to start by making it strange, and by making it strange also recover some sense of the wonder that we can actually encounter something so peculiar that is nonetheless in some sense or other ours.
Stephen Greenblatt, tell me about the argument that Shakespeare is culturally universal, that here is a passionate artistic genius that speaks across the ages, that has somehow become inviolate, that he is morally coherent and consistent, and therefore above our own political squabbles. It's a variation on this question about new historicism.
From my way of thinking, to make Shakespeare a cultural universal, to make Shakespeare float up above the rag and bone shop of human life, of human history, is basically to make him bloodless and uninteresting. Of course, in some sense, at a high level of abstraction, we could say that Shakespeare is universal. And of course, there's plenty of evidence for this. What's exciting about teaching Shakespeare, in fact, is that Shakespeare can be performed in Lagos, in Nigeria, in Jerusalem, in Chiang Mai, in Thailand, in Japan, where he's one of the most beloved playwrights, as well as in Stratford-upon-Avon. That's uh-huh. true. But I am not by any means convinced that the Shakespeare who is performed in Chiang Mai or in Prague is the same Shakespeare that's performed in Stratford-upon-Avon, or that that's the most interesting thing, is to see what happens if we strip away absolutely everything to get to some kind of disembodied, bloodless essence.
Which comes first for you, Stephen Greenblatt, the art or the, what do we call it, the social, the political, the historical? How, and if it's a chicken and an egg, how do you figure out the differences between the two?
I'm not sure that for Shakespeare's time, the boundary between what you're calling the art and what you're calling the political was as clear as you're imagining that it is for ourselves. I'm not sure it's so clear for ourselves, for that matter. But it is the case that there's a certain license that a writer, playwright had in Shakespeare's time that he wouldn't have had if he were writing a theological tract. Now, that's true. On the other hand, Shakespeare is writing for a censored company. All of the scripts have to go to a government official. This is not an art that is somehow taking place in a zone absolutely set apart.
You said that Shakespeare's chief task was to get people into the theater. I mean, after all, he was, you know, not to sound too crass here, he was interested in making a buck, in sustaining the, you know, the audience and all of that. Man, that really takes the wind out of the sails of this great artistic monument back there, or does it?
Well, I don't think it takes the wind out of the sails. I think it makes clear why these plays came out the way they did. Of course, Shakespeare was unusual in the sense that he actually made some money off it. Most playwrights starved to death in the period. It wasn't a very good business to go into. Shakespeare was amazingly successful at it and was one of the few playwrights from the period who actually could make a living.
You told me that Shakespeare packs more into the plays than, I can't remember your exact words, not than is necessary, but there's more there than is needful. Is that a good way to put it?
There's room for argument about this. There are people who think that if you speak Shakespeare extremely fast, almost as fast as I speak, you can get through a Shakespeare play in an afternoon. But if you've ever lived in England, you know that it gets dark very early, not to speak of rainstorms that come by. And I think it's extremely unlikely that any Shakespeare play, let alone big ones like Hamlet or Lear, could ever have been put on without being drastically cut. That is to say, Shakespeare almost always gives you more than his company or any company could possibly do. He expected the plays to be continually reshaped. And let me go back to the question of Taming of the Shrew, Merchant of Venice, and so forth. These are plays that are not set and fixed. They demand that we, especially if we're going to make them alive, if mm-hmm. we're going to perform them, that we cut and reshape them.
Well, you use words like mobile, complex, elusive, and disturbing. That's the one that gets to the critics, the ones who say that you're back there, that here at Berkeley and Harvard, you're destroying Shakespeare. You're attacking the bard somehow or other by recognizing the complexity and the disturbing qualities.
I think that I started by saying I was a priest in the cult, and I think the only way of keeping the love for these objects, of understanding what they were alive, of teaching new generations to love them, is precisely by keeping them open.
Stephen, what do you say to the parents of the students that you teach, again, at Berkeley and Harvard? Now, this is, you know, these are schools that don't come with low price tags. Parents send their kids off, and they spend a lot of money to have them sit in your classroom, and yet you have been criticized as somebody who is doing something bad to Shakespeare. What is your responsibility, or the joy, or the burden? How do you think of what you do when you walk into the classroom with these kids?
I would say, first of all, I am very grateful grateful to be in the classroom, and I'm aware, sometimes painfully aware, of how lucky I am. I think that I'm not. I won't speak for whether my students are lucky, but the act of teaching Shakespeare, or for that matter, the other things that I teach, it seems to me a kind of miraculous gift. But the miracle of the gift is precisely to treat these objects not simply as inert, not as dead letters, not as museum pieces, but as something, as works that are still alive.
Where did your passion for Shakespeare come from, Stephen Greenblatt?
Where does it come from? It comes from the first time, actually not the first time, Wayne, come to think of it, the first time I read Shakespeare, I remember reading As You Like It in junior high school and thinking it was about the worst play I have ever read. I hated it. I can still remember the words, sweet my cuz, be merry, with a shudder. So that it's sometime later, I think actually it came with reading Shakespeare, and even more seeing Shakespeare for the first time in high school.
Are you optimistic about what is not necessarily what you're doing, but what's going on with Shakespeare today in our classrooms in the 1990s? You look to the future optimistically?
I do, actually. I'm quite optimistic, not because English professors are clever, but because Shakespeare is remarkably tenacious and vital, and because people from extremely diverse backgrounds can intervene.
Stephen Greenblatt teaches at the University of California at Berkeley and is a regular visiting professor at Harvard University. His recent books include Shakespearean Negotiations and Marvelous Possessions. Stay tuned for information about writing for a cassette tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was literary scholar Stephen Greenblatt. Major funding for this program came from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of literature and language. Audio tapes are available post-paid for $10. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 757. That's number 757, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about one of the enduring relics of Christianity. Art historian John Scott of the University of Iowa will be here to discuss his new book about the Shroud of Turin. Until next week, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.